so much for joining me today. This is Ellen Kamai, the natural nurse. And as always, we are wishing you the best. We're so happy that you join us right here on Progressive Radio Network. Every week, we're on live at 10 to 11 a.m. You can grab the PRN app at any app store, Progressive Radio Network, and listen live any time of day because there's so many live shows. We're on Tuesday, 10 to 11 a.m., but truthfully, nowadays, with the Internet being what it is, time and space has pretty much evaporated because you can listen anytime in any space from anywhere, and we're happy that you do. We're seeing hundreds of thousands of downloads of our podcast. We're really happy to see that because it makes it worthwhile to bring you this information. Also, our lectures and presentations are packed, and you are certainly invited to join us in person. Last night, I did a presentation in Florida. I was really well attended, and that was called Herbs and Extraterrestrials. We lectured on both topics, and it was a very, very interested group of people, so happy to be able to do that. We have classes coming up every day. Just go to naturalnurse.com calendar. Most of them are available to access online. Some of them are on ground. A big on-ground one coming up, May 20th, is our Chinatown walk, where we actually go to Chinatown, take whoever would like to come along, and learn about all about Chinese herbal medicine. We do Qigong in the park. We visit Chinese apothecaries. We go underground to, believe it or not, an FDA-regulated facility that prepares herbal medicine. And you will never get to see that without coming on our trip with the natural nurse and Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro. So today, we're very happy to have as our guest Dr. Glenn Livingston. And we're going to talk about his topic, Never Binge Again. And he says, reprogram yourself to think like a permanently thin person. Glenn is a veteran psychologist and was the longtime CEO of a multi-million-dollar consulting firm, which has serviced Fortune 500 clients in the food industry. And he was disillusioned by what traditional psychology had to offer for overweight and food-obsessed individuals, so he spent several decades researching the nature of binging and overeating via work with his own patients and a research program with more than 40,000 participants. Most important, however, was his own personal journey out of obesity and food prison, I like that word, food prison, to a normal, healthy weight and a much more enlightened and lighthearted relationship with food. The best place to find Glenn is neverbingeagain.com. So thank you so much for joining us as our guest today, Glenn Livingston.
I am delighted to be here. I've been looking forward to this.
So I think you're using some very interesting terms. And, you know, up front, you are putting out there that this is your professional focus, but also you had a personal foot in the door here. And I have to say, for me, the struggle has been understanding this. To me, it's really seems like just what you would say with any kind of addictive tendency. I don't actually even understand overeating and binging. I mean, from a personal level, because to me, food is like, I do it now and then because I have to. Like, I have no interest in it. And it's not I wake up in the morning and think about what I'm going to eat that day or anytime soon or ever. And I really like eating things that are super healthy, and that's what I like to eat. So I sort of don't have a struggle with it, and I just wonder why that struggle is so widespread.
Well, boy, I got to tell you, there are probably a lot of people listening who would kill to have your predisposition towards food. And I do talk to people who, for whom food is not a big deal. They gravitate towards healthy food. They don't really understand the whole overeating, binge eating mentality. And so I'm jealous. I wish I hadn't had to work to become like you. I wish I didn't have to go through 25, 30 years of suffering to get there. And I bet there are a lot of people who are jealous of that perspective also. I think in large part it probably is because you have gravitated towards the healthier foods.
The reason I think it's genetic at all, because my parents, God bless them, who are 92 and 88, they are running around, and I mean running, swimming, dancing, driving, having a full life. They, you know, look like they're in their 50s or 60s, and they're not interested in food either. They eat a little bit and only whole food. They don't think about it. It's not like that's a religion to them. That's another thing. I find that people often, like, their whole thing is about food. My parents don't think about food. They eat three times a day, small, simple meals. That's it. So some of it might be behavioral, and some of it might be genetic.
I believe some of it is genetic. I think that a predisposition to gravitate towards whole foods is really an advantage, and whether that predisposition comes from genetics or the way that we're raised or, you know, philosophies that we're exposed to. I used to do a lot of consulting for the food industry, and what happens is that they put billions of dollars of research into engineering these hyper-palatable concentrations of sugar and starch and olive oil and excitotoxins and salt and all these things that they're like supersized stimuli. They're things that didn't exist as we were evolving.
Like that term, supersized stimulants. That reminds me of that movie, Supersize Me, which is pretty indicative of what you're talking about as well.
Yeah. I mean, look, there were no chocolate bars in the Savannah, right? We didn't have bags and boxes and containers and chips and pretzels and pizza and all of these things that are really products of industry, things that I'm not saying people can't enjoy them once in a while if they're okay with having them once in a while.
Yes, big time. I always tell my clients, you can have anything once a week. You know, that's different than every day and three times a day, which is usually where they're at.
Yeah. Some people can't, though. For some people, none is easier than sometimes.
Okay.
A lot of people can, and I work with both types of people, but, you know, I happen to be one of those people. I can't eat chocolate, for example. My sister can take two little squares out of her purse and fold up the rest for later, and I don't know what's wrong with her. I just can't do that. So for some people, none is easier than sometimes, but
right, and I guess that's true with many different addictive behaviors. Like there are alcoholics, you know, someone else could have a drink once a week, and alcoholics can never have a drink, according to when they make that commitment, it seems.
Exactly, yeah. You know, there was a series of studies in the late 50s and early 60s where they showed what happens when you short-circuit the pleasure center. These were not ethical vegan studies or anything like that, but they were done with rats initially and then with higher mammals and eventually with humans. So they put an electrode in the pleasure center of the rat's brain, and then they linked that electrode to a lever that the rat could press, and so the rat could self-stimulate and get pleasure in the brain, you know, in the whole dopaminergic system without the normal methods. And what they found was that the rats did that to the exclusion of everything else. They pressed the button thousands of times a day. They would ignore their nursing pups. They would climb over painful electrical grids. A starving rat would ignore its food in order to press that button thousands of times a day. And what I think that shows is that when you short-circuit the evolutionary mechanism for deriving pleasure, that severe self-neglect results. Severe self-neglect. People ignore their survival drives. And I don't think it's a really far stretch to look at what's happening in industry and say that we're being given those pleasure buttons. And I think that this kind of goes back to your first question, like why for some people is it such a big deal and for others it's not. I think the more that people have gravitated towards those industrial pleasure buttons, the bags and boxes and containers that didn't exist on the Savannah as opposed to whole foods, the more obsessed they've become with that shortcut, neurological pleasure, and the more that neurological pleasure has caused them to forget their best laid plans and goals and really other essential needs. to the point where people feel like they can't live without that chocolate bar or a bag of Doritos or you know, pizza or whatever it happens to be. And they feel like there are two minds. They can rationally and cognitively reason out how they want to eat, what they believe is healthy. But then, you know, Monday afternoon when there's a chocolate bar sitting in the counter at Starbucks and they hear this voice in their head that says, hey, chocolate grows on a cocoa bean, a cocoa bean grows on a plant, and therefore chocolate's a vegetable, it actually starts to make a little bit of sense to them, and they scrap all their plans. And that's because all of these industrial products, they really target the lizard brain. They target...
Wait a minute. Don't throw that word out so quickly there, because I want to talk about, like, what the heck does that mean? You're just throwing in lizard brain. What is a lizard brain?
Well, so if you think about the evolution of our brains, in the earliest part of our evolutionary history, we had reptiles, right? I'm sure an evolutionary biologist would put me to shame with this, but I'm going to bastardize it for the purpose of illustration. When the reptiles evolved, their way of thinking was really meat or kill. You see something in the environment, and the decision was, do I eat it, do I mate with it, or do I kill it? There wasn't really concern with love or impact on the tribe or, you know, or spirituality or music or, you know, contribution to society or anything like that. All the things that we think of as human. It was really just eat, mate, or kill. And it's a very, very primitive part of the brain, and that's the level at which these addictive substances function. And when they get you, what they're really doing, see there's a function. There's a benefit to eat, mate, or kill, right? There's a there's kind of a survival benefit, but it's misdirected. It's your body's forced to create a biological error. And you start to believe that you need these things in order to survive. It's the later evolved structure, like the mammalian brain starts to be able to inhibit that eat, mate, or kill impulse for concerns of how it's going to impact the rest of the tribe. And then the human brain, the neocortex, the logical brain, that's the part of the brain that can inhibit both the mammalian brain and the lizard brain to say, well, but how does this fit in with my long-term goal? What about our plans? What about all those, you know, not only just diet and exercise, but how does this affect the kind of person that I want to be in the world? How is it going to affect my, you know, spirituality and love relationships and arts and music and contribution and all the things that make us uniquely human? What happens is the addictive substances with food and other addictive substances as well, they really target that earliest evolved part of the brain, and they make us forget who we are and who we want to be in the world, what else is important to us. That actually turns out to be really important in terms of understanding how to deal with it, because most people, myself included, I was telling my personal story, but I had a horrific problem with overeating. And because I come from a family of psychologists, I tried to love myself thin for 30 years. I figured it wasn't what I was eating, and it was what was eating me. And I learned a lot about myself as a person. It was a good journey to take, but it didn't solve the problem. Because really, to solve the problem, in my estimation, what you need to do is learn how to dominate that lizard brain. It's not a matter of love. Lizards don't know love. They know eat, mate, or kill. They respect authority. They fear authority.
I just have to throw this out there. I know that that's probably been scientifically proven, but I am a pet person. I've had all kinds of animals. I have my own farm with goats and chickens and all that. And I've had a lot of reptile pets. And I would have to say that they do seem to have a recognition of various individuals and, you know, have a certain sense of self that perhaps we don't give them credit for, you know, on a scientific level. So I just want to throw that out there. I've had snakes, and I have iguanas right now. I have big, giant iguanas that live outside wild, and they definitely, you know, sort of recognize, let's say, me versus another person. And perhaps that's because I bring them food. right? But it seems to be a little bit more there than we give them credit for.
Well, I would be willing to acknowledge that. I haven't really investigated that, but I trust your experience. I would still say that as a general paradigm for understanding how to deal with overeating, that it's useful to understand that this is something you need to dominate more than love and nurture back to health. And so I don't want people to go out and abuse actual lizards in the world. but I guess you'll see in a couple of minutes that the paradigm that I'm arguing for involves separating your constructive versus destructive thoughts about food.
Okay, those are good also. So you're saying, you know, that lizard brain is just about like eating all you can right away.
Yeah. The lizard brain is the one that says that chocolate is a vegetable, and it doesn't matter what rules we made about chocolate or what diet we were trying to follow, chocolate is a good thing. We should have as much as we want right now because it's yummy. Let's go get some. And I'm arguing for the idea that that's the part of our brain we have to treat a little bit more like an alpha wolf would treat a challenger. If you think about the alpha wolf in a pack, when some other wolf challenges that wolf for leadership, the alpha wolf snarls at it and growls at it and basically says, look, get back in line or I'll kill you, right? It's like, I'm the boss here, you're subservient, and my decisions go. And so, would it be okay if I backed up and just kind of told you what I went through and how I came to
that? Well, of course it would be okay. We would definitely like to hear about that.
So, you know, I was a fairly active, tall, muscular adolescent. And I figured out that if I worked out for 2.5 to 3 hours a day, I could eat anything that I wanted to. So multiple pizzas, boxes of muffins, lattes, multiple chocolate bars, whatever I wanted to have, like 6,000-7,000 calories a day on average was no problem. And as I got older and had more responsibilities and got married and was seeing patients, I just didn't have the time to do that, and my metabolism slowed down, and I started gaining weight because I found that these foods had a hold on me and I couldn't stop.
And that's kind of a simple in and out. You continued with this high caloric intake, but the activity level reduced.
Yes, and I think my metabolism probably dropped also as I got older. And I was sitting a lot, I was driving a lot, absolutely. And so, you know, the doctors were yelling at me and telling me that my triglycerides were at ridiculous levels and I was going to have a heart attack in my 30s, and I just couldn't stop. And I was obsessed with it also. Like, it was more than just the physical aspect. It was how much it bothered me that I'd be sitting and working with a suicidal patient or with a couple after an affair or someone that I really had to be 100% present for. And I couldn't be because I couldn't stop thinking about the food. And I tried going to, I come from a family of 17 psychologists, so therapists. So I tried going to the best psychologists and psychiatrists, and I went to Overeaters Anonymous and really spent decades on a soul-searching journey to figure out what was eating me that was causing me to do this. And then when I finally started to figure out about the neurology, I ran across some alternative addiction treatment literature by Jack Trimpe at Rational Recovery. I realized that maybe I was going about it the wrong way, and that what I needed more was a scheme for recognizing when the lizard brain was active and like waking up and recognizing that that wasn't really me and my goals, and being able to step aside, remember who I was and what I wanted, and get those extra microseconds to make the right decision. And it turned out to be something really, really, really simple. I'm almost embarrassed about it because it's really primitive and simple. But basically, I would make really clear lines between what was healthy and unhealthy for me personally. So, for example, I started with things like, well, I'll never eat chocolate on a weekday again. I'll only ever have chocolate on the weekend. And then if I heard a little voice in my head that said, hey, chocolate's a vegetable, and it's really fine to have during the week because, you know, you need to have more vegetables or something like that, I'm exaggerating. It could be something simpler like, well, hey, a little won't hurt. I would say, well, that's, I called my lizard brain my inner pig, and I would say, well, that's pig squeal, and chocolate on a Wednesday is pig slop. And I don't eat pig slop, and I don't live farm animals. Tell me what to do.
So let me ask you this. First of all, I'm a little fascinated by your use of chocolate as kind of, you know, the bad guy just in your discussion and as an example, because I would use something more like bread, to tell you the truth. I think people get a lot further when they look at bread as the devil, meaning anything made out of wheat. But chocolate in particular is interesting because more recently there's been so much research on how very healthy it is, actually, not along with all the sugars and emulsifiers and everything, but it actually is a fruit because it's from the fruit of a tree. It's a seed. So it's interesting but that must be something that you have struggled with.
It's definitely something I would personally struggle with, and I'm not talking about, like, raw cacao powder. I'd be talking about chocolate bars with, you know, a lot of added fat and sugar.
Right, the sugar and the fat and the sugar, you know, taste and all that stuff, like a commercial chocolate bar. But it's just interesting because some people are going, oh, I thought chocolate told me. So, yeah, there's a lot of things that might be that pull. Now, did you ever use a technique that I find is helpful for many people that I have worked with where having something else there as a replacement, actually with you at all times? So when you get that urge, you have something else to put in your mouth.
I think that that's essential, actually. Because what's happened with the industrial products is your body's forced to make a biological error. So let's take bread, for example. Perhaps the person is craving, you know, some type of carbohydrate energy. And so if they had bananas in the car, some people don't believe in bananas, some people are eating low carb or whatever, but if you have something that would replace that energy, maybe it's chlorophyll or spirulina pills or something like that, but you want to retrain your body. This is why I tell people to welcome the cravings, because when you have the craving, that's an opportunity to retrain your body back to where it really belongs.
So you have to take a step back as an adult, right? Get out of that just lizard reactive kind of thing. You have to be able to, I guess, see yourself having this urge and then also be prepared to address it by having a replacement.
Yes. Yes, that's exactly right. So, for example, for chocolate, for me, I found that when I crave chocolate, I really seem to be craving chlorophyll. I know it sounds crazy, but underneath my craving for chocolate was a craving for leafy green vegetables. And so I started putting kale juice and a half a pound of leafy greens and a few bananas in the blender whenever I crave chocolate. And before I knew it, I found that I was craving that drink instead of craving the chocolate.
Wow, that is very interesting, especially because chocolate is so high in similar molecules in terms of bioflavonoids, et cetera. What about if you're out, though? What about if you're driving around or you're going to a job? You know, you had places that you went and an office, and it happens then, and you can't stop and make a smoothie. So, you know, what would your reaction be?
Well, I usually have things in the car.
That's a good idea.
I might have some tomatoes and dates. Now, sometimes I will have some pre-washed greens in the car, and I'll just eat them in the car. I know people think that's a little weird, but sometimes I do that. Or a head of lettuce that's been washed in a bag, I'll kind of take it with me if I know that I'm going to be doing that. If I'm really stuck and I don't have the opportunity, you can usually get a piece of fruit at, you know, most delis or even Starbucks has fruit. So there's always something. But I try not to put myself in the situations. I try to, when I get up in the morning, to take a look at my day and think through what the food challenges might be and do a little planning ahead of time. And
I always pack grab-and-go bags once a week because my time is extremely limited. I have time to think about it each day. So when you open my refrigerator, I actually have little bags of almonds and cut up celery and rice cakes. I find are very satisfying. You know, if I'm just out and I can't get to a healthy meal, and since I won't go in and grab a bagel because that's just not something I want to do, nor do I like it. See, that helps me because I'm not fighting with myself because I don't even like it. But by having those alternatives there And I find I'll hand them out to everyone who happens to be with me, and they'll eat that, and then that will stop them from, let's say, going for that craved item.
That's a terrific idea, and I have a lot of clients that do that. Sometimes I do that also. I don't usually need to because I work at home. But if I'm going to be traveling or I'm going to be having a week with an extraordinary number of appointments, then I'll do some food prep on Sundays and have those grab-and-go bags, and that works out really well for me, too. But
yeah,
by the way, one of the very practical things that I'm sorry?
I said, you know what, we're going to go to our little break right here, Glenn, and I want to reintroduce you, and then we'll come back and continue our discussion. Very, very fascinating with how you looked into this, made changes for yourself, and we want to hear the outcome also for yourself and your clients. And I want to remind people that you're listening to The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Our eminent guest today is Dr. Glenn Livingston, talking about Never Binge Again. Reprogram yourself to think like a permanently thin person, and we will continue investigating that. His website, which you can look at now, he has a free book download there, which is a wonderful book, and it's called NeverBingeAgain.com. We will be right back with more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
The Progressive Radio Network is a thinking person's network for our world's progressive visionaries and stakeholders and great thinkers to assemble on a commercial-free and listener-supported network. Our provocative hosts speak freely and passionately on intriguing and urgent topics such as health and news and politics and women's issues and philosophy and more that directly impact our lives. Progressive Radio Network takes chances. Our voices and ideas are not always welcomed by corporate media. So Progressive Radio Network is a very important outlet for these great thinkers.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss Sar sarsaparilla, or Smilax officinalis.
Sar sarsaparilla is a tropical plant which grows in South America, Mexico, and Guatemala. Although most Americans are familiar with it as a flavor enhancer for root beer, it has also been used for its beneficial properties for hundreds of years by many different cultures. In Roman times, the young shoots were eaten, and the mature vines were worn as garlands at festivals of Bacchus. According to ancient Roman writings, Sar sarsaparilla originated when the beautiful maiden, Smilax, was turned into a shrub after her love was slighted by the young crocus.
Sar sarsaparilla was brought to Europe in the 16th century by Spanish traders. A French physician, Nicolas Monardus, published a comprehensive account of Sar sarsaparilla as a treatment for syphilis in 1574. During Portuguese military operations in 1812, a British inspector general of hospitals noted its positive effect on syphilis patients. It has also been used in China for treatment of the same condition. Sar sarsaparilla was included in the United States Pharmacopoeia until 1950 as a recommended treatment of secondary syphilis.
Sar sarsaparilla's medicinal action appears to be a result of binding bacterial endotoxins in the gut, thereby decreasing their absorption. This greatly reduces the stress on the liver and is likely responsible for its historic use as a tonic and blood purifier.
In a controlled study of 92 patients published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 1942, a chemically active component of Sar sarsaparilla called Sar saponin greatly improved psoriasis in 62% of the patients and resulted in complete clearance in 18%. Sar sarsaparilla is often recommended by naturopathic physicians for gout, arthritis, and psoriasis. Another folkloric use for Sar sarsaparilla is as a tonic for male sexual potency.
So, if you want a root beer flavored tea with a long history as a healthy tonic, reach for the Sar sarsaparilla in your natural medicine chest.
Welcome back. Thank you so much for joining us. We'd love to see you. Visit us at naturalnurse.com. Click on calendar on the top and join in on any class, either online. By the way, if you are a health professional, such as a nurse, acupuncturist, or massage therapist, our classes offer CE credits, continuing ed credits, towards your license. If you're not a licensed health professional, then you can get a certificate for taking any of our classes and workshops. We have one going on right now that is called the Natural Nurse Herbal Certification Course, and that's still open. You can join in on that. And we have many, many one-day presentations and lectures in all aspects of natural and holistic living. Check that out at naturalnurse.com calendar. We've also written many books. We have about 15 books. Look at naturalnurse.com books and all kinds of information for you for free, including these radio shows like the one that we're doing today. We archive those, and also at Progressive Radio Network, you can find our shows online all the time. Get the Progressive Radio Network app or the phone line. As a matter of fact, Progressive Radio Network has been voted number 3 in the country and number 15 in the world for people who listen by calling our phone number. So that's pretty amazing as well. So we're so happy to offer all these ways to get information. And today our guest is Dr. Glenn Livingston, PhD. His website is neverbingeagain.com, and he is sharing with us information he has gleaned through years of study, both on himself, and also we want to talk about where he got 40,000 participants that really helped him develop something that works and will work for you. If you're someone who struggles with, I guess, your relationship with eating, is we'll call it that. Maybe Dr. Glenn has a better name for it. So welcome back, Dr. Glenn Livingston.
Well, thank you very much. It's good to be here again.
So tell us about the 40,000 participants. That's a very respectable number to base your not just assumptions on, but your recommendations on.
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. The actual results of the study were interesting, but they actually pointed to the opposite of what actually kind of consolidated the fact that I was going down the wrong path rather than pointing me to the right path. Where I got the people was on the Internet. It was back in the days when clicks were very cheap. I used pay-per-click advertising back in the late 1990s, very early 2000s, and I ran a site for about 3.5 years. And basically, I was collecting information about people's satisfaction with different areas of their life, other personality variables, and the foods with which they had trouble stopping. So, you know, chips or bread or bagels or pizza or, you know, salty, fatty things, any type of food that people typically binge on. I wanted to collect information about it. And then I looked for correlations. And I found three things. I found that people that struggled with chocolate, like me, they tended to be more lonely or brokenhearted. There was something that they kind of felt was missing in their interpersonal life. People that struggled with salty, crunchy things tended to be more stressed at work. And people that struggled with soft, chewy things, like, you know, like bread and pasta and like starch in a soft or chewy form, they tended to be more stressed at home. And I thought that was really interesting.
Well, that is fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. I never heard that. That is like really very deep information for people to look at for themselves.
Well, it leads to some very soulful insights and conversations and digging. So for example, I asked my mom, who's also a psychotherapist, I said, Mom, you know, obviously I'm not in a great marriage. I'm divorced now. And, you know, I am kind of lonely and brokenhearted, but is there anything in my history that you think would lead me to run to chocolate when I'm feeling lonely, brokenhearted, or depressed? And she got this horrible look on her face, and she said, I'm kind of ashamed, but, you know, when you were a toddler or even smaller, you would come running to me, you know, crying. I couldn't always manage it because I was really depressed myself. My dad was in prison. Your father, my husband, was a captain in the Army, and we were talking about taking him to Vietnam. And I was really depressed, and I just couldn't take the constant crying and, you know, requests that you have. And so I couldn't hug you and feed you all the time. I kept a bottle of chocolate Bosco in the refrigerator on the floor. And I said, go get your Bosco, and you go running, and you'd suck on the bottle.
What did you say, Bosco? I remember that.
Do you remember? Now you're my new best friend, because hardly anybody remembers that, so that's great. Yeah, and I'd apparently go suck on the bottle and go into a chocolate coma. And
wow, that's revelatory. So for those listeners who are maybe a little younger than us, Glenn, Bosco is a chocolate syrup.
Yeah, it was really good, too.
It was, I have to say. Now, I liked it. You know, so I had it once, and not like that I need it again. So that has to do with, that's very fascinating that actually is, and then that chocolate became an issue for you. That is both addictive due to its soothing qualities, and then you did that research looking at the fact that it reflects similarly on particular traits in terms of anxiety versus something else going on in someone's life, and they may have a proclivity to use whatever food substance that is to try to quench that feeling.
Yeah. Well, see, now if this were the movie, at this point, you know, my mom and I would have a good cry and a big hug, and I would stop eating chocolate. Like, I would have had that insight, and that would have cured everything, and I would stop eating chocolate. My mom and I did have a big hug and a little cry, and we, you know, we forgave each other, and I did feel softer and more compassionate with myself. It helped that negative voice that happens after we binge. I wasn't as hard on myself after that. But it didn't stop the binging. In some ways, it actually made it worse. And the reason is I found that there was this little voice in my head that would say, you know what, Glenn, you're right. Our mama didn't love us enough. And until we can go out and find the love of our life and fill that big empty hole inside your heart, we're going to have to just keep on binging on chocolate. Yippee, let's go get some right now. And when I tried to work with patients who were eating, you know, salty, crunchy things or, you know, bread and bagels, they would have a very similar voice in their head that kind of used the emotional insight as a justification to actually eat worse. And I thought, what is going on here? This doesn't make sense. This is not how it's supposed to work from everything I know in psychology. And what I finally figured out, and this was in large part from reading Jack Trimpe's work, was that in addiction, the attempt to love yourself thin, often, if you have the kind of addiction that people like me have, it just doesn't work. Because
love
there is
yourself
that
thin. That's interesting. Another thing that has worked with some of my clients is when they're constantly, you know, you say, like you say, into these revolving door kind of patterns with not being able to stop the eating. The other thing I say is, you know what? How about if you just get bigger clothes and love yourself as you are? And that sometimes really shocks them into making better choices.
That's perfectly okay with me also. You know, I think we live in a culture that has an unnaturally thin body image, and there is such a thing as fat shaming, and I'm definitely a proponent of people accepting themselves how they are. And paradoxically, when they do that, they tend to start to lose weight. It's really interesting.
Yes, that's what I'm saying, because maybe it cuts down on that internal struggle so much.
Well, and what we found is that the voice of that inner lizard that's so self-castigating after a mistake, it's actually binge-motivated in and of itself, because the purpose of it is to wear you down so that you feel too weak to resist the next binge. And so it's like Carol Munter says, it's very difficult to keep overeating and binging if you refuse to yell at yourself. When people can, when they can stop perseverating on the guilt and shame, and instead forgive themselves definitely pay attention. Like if you touch a hot stove, you want to figure out how you're not going to touch it again and what did you miss and what are you going to do differently. But you don't say, oh, my God, I'm a pathetic, compulsive hot stove toucher. I might as well put my whole hand on the stove, right? You just make adjustments and you move on and you don't touch it again. When people can do that, when they can let go of that negative voice and instead look for evidence of success, because like in every mistake, there's also something that went better. Maybe you had 3 cupcakes instead of 15. Maybe the binge went on for an hour instead of all day. Maybe it, maybe you broke your chocolate rule, but you kept to your bread rule. Whatever it is, if you can look for evidence of success, you will build a success identity and eventually become a successful person. Kind of like if you're shooting at an archery target, you know, if you miss the bullseye and you get up and you try again and you think about, well, did I not account for the air resistance? Is it further away? Should I pull a little harder? If you keep doing it, you have to get better because we're set up as learning machines. I mean, our neurology or biology is set up to learn. If we don't get derailed and just like say, screw it, I'm going to shoot all the rest of the arrows up in the air and to be, you know, off to the side or something like that because I'm pathetic and I can't do it. So a big part of recovering from overeating is letting go of that negative, shaming, perseverating voice that says that you're pathetic and you're never going to get it. And that's a piercing insight for a lot of people. They don't really understand that, yes, it's okay to feel a little shame and guilt just to get your attention, but anything beyond that is really you're indulging the lizard brain and allowing it to wear you down so you become more likely, not less likely, to binge in the future. Does that make sense?
It does make sense. But, you know, it's a lot about playing games with yourself. Like, you know, having the concept that, wow, I'm in some kind of emotional binge mode. There's certainly an addiction here. We haven't used that word, but would you agree that this fits into, you know, an addiction pattern?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. I mean, if you think about those animal studies and the level of self-neglect that results, and I would say the critical question is, are you looking for love at the bottom of a bag, box, or container, right? Or sometimes not a bag, box, or container, but you know what I mean. Does it feel like you can't live without it? Does it feel like your life purpose is starting to get organized around this substance, and then you know that you're really struggling with an addiction? Yeah, it is an addiction. But it's very breakable. See, in our culture, we're told that you can't beat an addiction. You can only abstain one day at a time. And you should struggle for progress and not perfection, and you should use guidelines instead of rules. And I think that that advice is mistaken. I think that if you look at the studies on willpower, we find that willpower is not really like an on and off switch that some people have and some people don't. It's more like gas in the tank. And you refuel that gas with rest, by taking good care of your blood sugar, by, you know, taking breaks to get away from making decisions. Decision making seems to be what wears down our willpower. There are only so many good decisions we can make over the course of a day. And that's why, by the way, people start out with the best laid plans in the morning and screw up in the evening and find themselves by the refrigerator or at the fast food place because they've made too many decisions that day and they're trying to rely on willpower. What trumps willpower are commitments to character. Like, I can ask people, do you think that you could give up bread during the week? And they might say, no, I could never do that. I feel too deprived. But then if I switch the question and I say, do you think you could become the kind of person who doesn't eat bread during the week? They'll say, maybe I could do that. So why is that? I think it's because we're accustomed to making character commitments without even thinking about it. Like if you walk into a diner and there's a $20 bill on the table because the waitress hasn't taken her tip and she hasn't even seen it. And she says, I'll be right back. I'm just going to go get you a menu. And there's no video camera, and there's nobody up front, and there's no window, and nobody would know if you take it. Virtually nobody tells me they're going to take that $20 bill. And I'll say, does it require any willpower? And they'll say, no. I'll say, why not? They'll say, well, I'm not that kind of person. I'm not.
Right. They just have an internal feeling about they would never take it, right? Unless maybe they were, you know, in a position where they had their kids and they were starving and the children were starving. So there's always that caveat. But we have to take another little break right here, Glenn. But when we come back, we will continue our conversation. Really fascinating. Some of the things that you have shared, I think, are very new information, even if people have thought they've heard everything about dealing with, you know, I would call it food addiction. So we will continue more, and we'll be talking about your book, Never Binge Again, right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we'll be right back with more.
Join the movement at PRN.FM, your best source for progressive programming.
Dire frontline data is difficult to hear but necessary to face if we're to have any chance of changing the current course of industrialized, militarized civilization, which is pushing us at blinding speed toward near-term total global extinction. This is Dane Wigginton with the Global Alert News Hour, brought to you commercial-free by geoengineeringwatch.org, the largest and most visited website in the world on the subject of illegal and ongoing climate engineering operations that are threatening the entire web of life. Tune in to PRN Radio on Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern Time for an hour of the latest and most dire frontline breaking news on the most critical threats we collectively face.
Are you interested in growing a greener future? Do you enjoy healthy, nutritious food? Would you like to learn how to grow your own organic oasis in an easy and efficient way? I'm Jackie Marie Beyer, the humble host of the Organic Gardener podcast, where I talk with amazing guests who are all using sustainable, earth-friendly practices. I interview backyard gardeners, market farmers, and people who have green businesses related to food. I'd love it if you'd join us on the Progressive Radio Network, coming on Monday evenings at 7 p.m.
You're listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
With more right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Thanks so much for joining us today. Our guest is psychotherapist Dr. Glenn Livingston, PhD, and we're talking about reprogram yourself to think thin, to think like a permanently thin person. This is great. And by the way, Glenn has a wonderful, totally free book to download called NeverBingeAgain.com. Why don't you tell us a little bit about the book, Glenn, and how it might be really useful to some of our listeners if they would like to do that, think like a permanently thin person?
Well, so the book itself, it was originally a journal that I kept about my battle between myself and my inner lizard brain, which I called my inner pig. It was a unfortunate choice of words, by the way, because you know, pigs are actually kind of cute, loving animals that need our help. But that's what I called it. I wasn't a vegan back then, and that's what I called it, me versus my pig. And most people tell me when they read it that they felt like I was reading to them from their own head, because it turns out that a lot of the justifications and rationalizations that inner voice gives us for breaking our best laid plans are very similar across people. You know, a little bit won't hurt. How do you know that you can, you know, stop eating this forever? you know, I can't get you now, but I'll get you later. A lot of the things that we all use to justify the next binge are very, very similar. And I didn't actually realize that at the time. I thought they were kind of unique to my inner workings, but they're not. So I edited the book into a book, and I was part of a minor publishing company, and they wanted to publish an example, and I was very reluctant to put it out there because I'm a sophisticated psychologist, and I did all this millions of dollars of consulting for industry, and I thought, am I really going to get out there on the radio and TV and talk about this inner pig inside me? But I did, and it got to be the number one book on the free side for weight loss and weight maintenance, and it's been
well. You know what? You have some very fresh new ideas, and tell us about your success with yourself, and maybe also some others that you may know of who have accomplished that goal.
Well, I'm down. My top weight was about 260, and I hover between 200 and 210 these days. I didn't lose hundreds of pounds or anything because I never really got to be 400 pounds, partially because I'm so big and I always did like exercise. But I've certainly worked with people who've lost hundreds of pounds, and the more common result, people lose a little weight, but they get control over, they reverse that feeling of powerlessness and hopelessness, and they restore their sense of enthusiasm and control over what they can eat, and they feel like the master of their own fate again. And then, you know, they lose weight at their own pace, and they're not as obsessed and desperate to lose weight because they know that it's going to happen. And I think the reason for that is, and you actually illustrated it really well in the very beginning, is that we're transforming that food obsession into having made the food decisions that previously troubled you, having kind of made the right decision a part of your character so that you don't even really have to think about it. And most people gravitate towards more whole natural foods as a result of this. I don't dictate what people eat in any way, shape, or form. I'll help you whatever you want to eat. The exception being some people come to me and say my food plan is that I'm frightened of eating entirely. I just don't want to eat anymore. I want to be a breatharian, and you know, it's got to be nutritionally complete, and it can't be dangerous. But I won't tell you what to eat. This works for all sorts of different diets. What we do is we look at the troublesome foods and food behaviors, and we make the decisions beforehand. We step back and we think through, well, what role do we want bread to play in our life? What about eating at the counter versus, you know, sitting at a table? What about eating in the car? What about do you want to put your fork down between bites? For everybody is different. Everybody has a different troublesome behavior, but this process isolates that troublesome behavior, helps you articulate what a better behavior would be, and then helps you to stamp it in so you eventually don't have to think about it. And that's basically what it is.
Well, that's ideal, to where it's just, you know, part of your just nature.
Yeah, I tell people it's like
the constant mental struggle with that.
Yeah, it's like learning to drive. It's, you know, initially you have to do a little studying and learn the rules of the road, but once you know the rules of the road, you don't really think about them, and you can kind of daydream while you're driving and just, you know, focus on where you're going and talking to friends or whatever you need to do.
We're going to get to the end here pretty soon, so I want people to understand how they can get in touch with you and how downloading your free ebook might be helpful and other services you can provide for them.
Sure. So when you go to neverbingeagain.com and you click the big red free reader bonus button, you can download the Kindle, Nook, or PDF version, depending on where you are and what's better for you. But not only that, this is kind of a weird theory when we talk about it in the abstract. I wanted people to be able to hear what it's like when I actually coach people through the system, because the enthusiasm in their voice and the change in their mindset is really contagious. So I recorded a bunch of sessions. That's all free also. And then I created a bunch of food plan starter templates. So I'm aware that there may be 10 or 12 different major dietary philosophies out there. And I want you to take responsibility for which one you want to follow and exactly how you want to follow it. But we created a set of templates to give you some sample rules that you might want to use to define, you know, the healthy versus unhealthy line for you personally. So that's all available at neverbingeagain.com if you go there. In terms of services that we offer, we do have a coaching program, both group and individual. We do have a program for people who want to use this to get themselves to exercise more. We're working on one for people who want to sleep better, even managing your finances. It's an interesting trick of mine that helps people stop defeating themselves, helps them stop getting in their own way, and we're applying it to all different areas of life. So it's all at neverbingeagain.com, and thank you for the opportunity to talk about that.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being our guest today. And we'd like you to know that Glenn is available there. I know you do some sort of, I guess, online help for people who need encouragement in sort of changing their mindset and into being thinking like a permanently thin person. And we're just about at the end of our time together, Glenn. Thank you so much for being our guest today right here on The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. And thank you, listeners, for joining us. We love to have you, and we love to hear from you. So feel free to contact us at naturalnurse.com. There's a contact button right there. Join us for any of our up-and-coming classes and workshops online or on ground, depending on where you physically are at a particular time. And until next time, this is Ellen Kamai, the Natural Nurse, hoping that you stay healthy.